Well, we appreciate the presence of each one on this beautiful April Sunday morning. Good to have our visitors with us. Glad you are here. I want you to come back, see us every time that you can. There are certain inevitabilities in life, that things that just are bound to happen. There are things that are going to happen a little bit later. Death, that's already happened to a lot of our kinfolk, all of our loved ones, our family. There's going to be judgment. There's going to be a resurrection prior to judgment. There's going to be heaven and hell to be experienced. Now those are eschatological or last thing inevitabilities. But there are other things that are features of life now, as we're still in the living of it, that happen too. And God knows all that's going to happen and transpire in my life, and He knows everything that's going to transpire in yours. And God sees it from the viewpoint of what He knows is going to occur. And I can be warned in Scripture with regard to what He knows I'm going to face. It's not if I'm going to face it, but when I'm going to face it. It's not just that it might turn out some way, but it is going to be like this, and you'd better be prepared. In fact, regarding certain features that are inevitably going to come up, others are going to collapse when they face it, and I'm giving you this information so that you won't. The lesson this morning and in this afternoon too, these are entitled, Make Sure It Won't Be You. Because, as I say, God has His mind on everybody and knows all that's going to happen in every life. Our life is precious. Our spirit is precious. The spirit outlasts the body, Matthew chapter 10, so guard it at all cost. Let the body go if you have to, but maintain the health, the nourishment, the strength, the vitality of your spirit. Don't let the devil get you by the realization that there are just certain things you're going to have to face, and He knows it. And God says, I'm telling you and I'm warning you, be careful about these things. The first point that I want to make goes back to Deuteronomy 17, 14 through 20, and also 1 Samuel chapter 8, because it's this practical lesson that has an historic base. Make sure it's not you that asks for another king. Make sure that it's not you that asks for another king. 1 Samuel chapter 8 is the historical moment in which it occurs. Deuteronomy 17 is a reporting of that by Moses. A recounting of that so that he can get the attention of the Jews before he passes away. So you can either go to 1 Samuel 8, the history, or Deuteronomy 17, where he reminds them of what had happened. But in any event, you recall that Israel got to the point where they were so tired of the judges and they didn't want Samuel's sons to be judges anymore. And so they said, make us a king, Samuel, to go before us, to fight our wars for us. And we want to be like the nations round about us. And let me suggest to you that God was not opposed, basically, to the arrangement of their having a king. But He was certainly opposed to the disposition that demanded one at that time. We'll talk about this more as we develop this thought. But I know in the light of subsequent history, but I also know in the light of Deuteronomy 17, verses 14 through 20, that God says, I know you're going to do this very thing. See, that's what He's saying. Later, they will do that in 1 Samuel 8. But here Moses is saying, God is saying, one of these days you people are going to say, we want a king. How did God know that? I don't know, except that He's omniscient. He knows everything. So He says, when God says that, then I want you to make sure that the king is like this, and this, and this, and this. So it's not that they had to fulfill the prophecy because their will was destroyed. It was that history just sort of compelled them to a moment all the features of their situation was conducing toward their rebellion. Where they said, we are tired of God being our king. Now they didn't say it like that. But I'll tell you this. They did not want an invisible God instead of a visible man. That's what they wanted, a visible man. They did not want a visible God. They wanted a visible man. Now I ask you, what about you today? What about me today? Is that the way that I look at life? Do I want a visible king or do I want the invisible God? Now it comes down to that finally. But as I say, he was not opposed to giving them the visible king, but he was opposed to the disposition that said, we're tired of this. We don't like the divine arrangement. We want another arrangement. And furthermore, we want an arrangement that puts us on a par with the nations that are round about us. You know, when they did that, they were really calling for a situation where they were going to go down instead of up. They were calling for a situation in which, instead of being advanced, they were degenerating in a way. Instead of being up here on the pedestal, we want to be the nation that is different from the rest of the nations. They did not see their significance. They did not appreciate their uniqueness. It's just like members of the church today that are always looking at themselves and comparing themselves with the denominations and trying every way in the world to be just like the denominations round about us because they can't stand to be unique. They don't want to be the covenant people of God. They want to just be in the mix. And that's the way you lose your soul. But that's the way it is. So, in Deuteronomy 17, he says, well, you can't have a king. You will ask for a king. And Moses says, but make sure the king is like this and this and this and this. 1 Samuel 8, of course, they do decide they want one and they demand one. And God says, Samuel, you tell them what a king will do to them and then you give them one. In Hosea 13, if you have your Old Testament, I want you to see something. If you've never read this verse or you've not read it recently, let's be impressed with it anew. In Hosea 13, Hosea is predicting the captivity of the northern kingdom, Ephraim, or Jacob. And he's telling them what's going to happen because of what they've done already. And down in verse 7, he says, God is going to be like a lion to you. God is going to be like a leopard to you. Verse 8, God is going to be like a bear to you. Look at verse 9. O Israel, thou hast destroyed thyself. Have you ever known a member of the church that destroyed himself? Have you ever known a congregation that destroyed itself? But in me is thine help. Now look at verse 10. I will be thy king, or the American Standard renders it, where now is thy king that may save thee? Look at here. Thy judges of whom thou saidst, give me a king and princes. Where's the king? Where are the judges? You said you wanted a king? You didn't want the judges? I gave you a king and princes? Where are they? How are they going to help you now? Now watch it. I gave thee a king in mine anger, and I took him away in my wrath. What happened to Saul? Same thing happened to a lot of them. They got rejected by God. But as I say, given Deuteronomy 17, he wasn't so much opposed to the arrangement as he was the disposition that called for it. But now when they displaced God and tried to have a substitute of a man in the place of God, they could not see what they were doing. Well, Matthew chapter 2, verse 2, when you come to the New Testament, Herod said, where is he that is born? Or the wise men said, where is he that is born? King of the Jews. Matthew 27, in his trial, verse 27, some of the Pharisees, hail, King of the Jews. John 18, 37, in his trial, Pilate said, art thou a king then? Art thou a king then? And of course he was, because in 2 Samuel chapter 7, God had promised David, I'm going to take one of your descendants and I'm going to set him upon a throne. His kingdom will be forever. 2 Samuel chapter 7, verses 12 through 17. And do you remember that in Hebrews chapter 1 and verse 8, the Hebrews writer, in showing the superiority of Jesus over angels, said, God never said this to an angel. My son, thy throne is forever and ever. And he said, the scepter of his kingdom is uprightness. Instead of holding a regal rod that indicates the power of the kingdoms of the world, the scepter that my son holds is uprightness. It's righteousness. That's what sets him apart. Oh, he has power. Don't misunderstand. There were those during his trial that put a crown of thorns on his head. Hail, King of the Jews! What mockery. You have to get past the mockery to see Jesus as He is. But in looking at the mockery, you see the willingness that characterized Him to bear the sins of the world on His own shoulders. He took the crown of thorns. God later gave Him the real royal regal crown. And He went to heaven, Acts 2:33, and sat down at the right hand of God. Now, what kind of king do you have? He's King of Kings and Lord of Lords in the book of Revelation. He has triumphed over sin and over death. And unless you have a king that has done that, you don't have much of a king. You have only a king that can help you temporarily and feebly for a moment in this life, but cannot even see you successfully through this, and certainly cannot land you safely on eternal shores. So what am I saying? I'm saying that when God even talked about the way that His people in the Old Testament would do, and He knew what they were going to say about a king, some of them did fall into that, all right. He still loved them. He wanted them. But no person on earth could substitute for God. And when God finally sent the final one who would be a king forever and ever, now that was something, of course, in which all men could, but would not place their hope. Jesus Christ is our King. We sometimes sing about crowning Him in our life, but He is the King of Kings whether we crown Him in our life or not. Don't ask for another king. 2 Corinthians chapter 11, Paul says, you don't want another gospel, you don't want another Christ, you don't want another spirit. He's saying in effect, you should not. Because he says there are some that are here that are preaching it that way. They preach another Jesus. They preach another gospel. They preach another spirit. You don't want to fall into that. And there's danger on every hand in America because of the huge number of false doctrines that permeate the atmosphere, all kinds of weird concepts and notions that you have to ward off all of the time. Always make sure that you do what Jesus said you must in John 8:31 and 32. If ye abide in my word, then are ye truly my disciples. And ye shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free. So, if somebody is going to ask for another king, make sure it's not you. Make sure it's not you. Secondly, and I want you to turn back to Deuteronomy chapter 30. We were in 17. Now let's go over to Deuteronomy chapter 30. And see something else that Moses was predicting about what Israel would do. And really, if you'll jump back just for a moment to chapter 28, hold your finger there at chapter 30 and go back to 28 verse 37. Moses had been outlining for them the curses and the blessings that are in the law of Moses. The second point is, make sure it's not you that apostatizes from the faith. If you're in the covenant, part of the covenant, have submitted yourself to the last will and testament of Jesus Christ, do not ever let any person our doctrine, our congregation, our book, our TV program, or whatever it is, cause you to apostatize from the faith. Now again, here, through Moses, the inspiration of Moses, he predicts their apostasy. They were going to fall. In fact, in that verse, God says, "Now, and thou shalt become an astonishment, a proverb and a byword among all nations, whither the Lord shall lead thee." Verse 41, "Thou shalt go into captivity." You leave me, you don't receive the blessings, you're going to get the curses, and the curses are going to result in a captivity, and then I'm going to scatter you throughout the world. That has happened. It happened a long time ago, and we still live in the results of that. Simply given the fact that the Jews have created, you know, a nation again in Israel, doesn't change this fact of the scattering of the Jews. What in the book of John earlier was called the dispersion, the diaspora, it's still with us this day, if I'm not mistaken. Aren't they scattered everywhere? But in chapter 30, Moses says, Deuteronomy 30, "And it shall come to pass, when all these things are come upon thee, the blessing and the curse, which I have set before thee, and thou shalt call them to mind," now watch it, "among all the nations, whither the Lord thy God hath driven thee." You're going to be out there, scattered people, and you're going to think about what I'm reminding you of this day. So, if you're scattered, if you're lost, if you get the curse instead of the blessing because of your own infidelity, horrible. But He told them about it. He warned them with regard to it. And most of them still fell away. Is that like us? Are we like they were? Are we going to fall away? Is it going to be like that? Shouldn't be like that. Doesn't need to be like that. And yet we've witnessed so much apostasy even in our day with regard to the gospel in the church. You can also go over to chapter 28, verses 37 through 41 for the same kind of point. In fact, I was looking at those verses. "Thou shalt beget sons and daughters, but thou shalt not enjoy them, for they shall go into captivity. And all thy trees and fruit of thy land shall the locust consume. The stranger that is within thee," verse 43, "shall get up above thee very high, and thou shalt come down very low. He shall lend to thee, and thou shalt not lend to him, and he shall be the head, and thou shalt be the tail." It's a reversal of their fortunes. If you just stay with me, God says, you can have it all. And you turn against me, and you have nothing. Have members of the church learned anything today? 2 Timothy 3, 1 through 5. There's going to come an apostasy. The Spirit says, the latter times some shall depart from the faith, giving heed to seducing spirits and doctrines of demons. It's going to be like that. Or 1 Timothy chapter 4, 1 through 5. Other passages. There's going to be apostasy. Make sure it is not you. You can't say, "Well, I'm just going to go with my friends." You can lose your soul on a platform like that. "I'm going to just go with some of my family members." You can lose your soul on a platform like that. What you have to say is, "I am going to stay with the gospel of Jesus Christ, regardless what my family does, regardless what my friends do, regardless what my enemies want. I am set." We studied a word this morning in 2 Peter chapter 1 in Bible class that had to do with you're being set in your mind, established. You're established with the present truth, Peter said. Your mind is firmly fixed. It is a settled thing. And that's the way that I have to take on life. I don't want to apostatize from the faith. Make sure it's not you. And I'll have to make sure it's not me. Number three. Somebody is going to cause somebody to stumble. This is Matthew chapter 18. And I want you to look at it with me. Make sure it's not you that causes that. As you survey the scene of your life, the way you live, the way you act, the way you are before others, this is a very sobering warning that comes to us. Jesus is trying to understand who is great. And it's somebody that's like a little child. Matthew chapter 18. Someone that's like a little child in disposition. Now, it's not like a little child in silliness or foolishness. Foolishness is bound up in the heart of a child. The rod of correction will drive it far from him. He's not talking about foolishness. He's talking about the disposition that sees itself in need of help. Always looking up the parents or others and needing. It's a vulnerable state. It's a weak state in a way. And you need help. You have to humble yourself. You don't see little bitty children usually that have entrenched themselves in arrogance. You don't usually see that. They realize vulnerability and weakness and they want help and they want security. And so he says, you've got to become like a little child if you want to enter the kingdom. Verse 4, you've got to humble yourself. But notice what he says in verses 5 and 6, and whoso shall receive one such little child in my name receiveth me. But whoso shall cause one of these little ones that believe on me to stumble, it is profitable for him that a great millstone should be hanged about his neck and that he should be sunk in the depth of the sea. What a picture. Now, I think he probably is talking about both. If you do this to the little child or you do to the one that's like the little child, one such. In other words, whoever causes an innocent child to lose his soul will pay for it. Whoever gets in his way. And whoever takes somebody that's like a little child, this proper disciple who's humbled himself, whoever gets in his way and causes him to stumble, he's going to pay for it. And he says it would be better if you had a prior experience of drowning by a weight attached to you than to have lived on into the privilege of having more moments, but which moments were used to cause these people to stumble. That's what he's saying. Be better not to have lived long enough to do this. Now you've lived long enough to do it, and you did it. Now let's read the next verse. This is what I'm talking about. The inevitabilities that we face in life. Woe unto the world because of occasions of stumbling. For it must needs be that the occasions come, but woe to that man through whom the occasion cometh. And then he starts saying, you know, you need to practice self-control so that you don't get into anybody's way. Now that's enormously important to comprehend. And when he says, it must needs be, that word, it's a word that signifies necessity or pressure. I like to think of it like the features of life all bringing to bear on a given moment. They're all conducing to a certain set of circumstances. It's sort of it's a pressure cooker. The inevitability of a stumbling, somebody causing a stumbling, it's just a feature of the world that is pressed into the world. All these things you have, including your own free will and vulnerability and ignorance, all these things, they're features that conduce and press, they compulse into a stumbling. And he says, that being the case, make sure you are not the vehicle. You are not the route through which the pressure is released so that somebody over here loses his soul. When you see somebody like that, you see, you're looking at today a faithful Christian. He's not getting in anybody's way. Do you realize that people that are not Christians are getting in somebody's way? They're getting in the way, not by virtue of trying to be in the way. They're not even trying to be obstinate. They may be very nice and kind people. But their life is a testimony to a doctrine that if believed, damns somebody else's soul. You ever thought about your nice kinfolk that are not Christians? They're in somebody's way. You thought about that? They're in somebody's way. Because they are not light and leaven and salt, and they have no reason, no justified reason for the hope that is within them, 1 Peter 3:15. And if these others that are looking at them follow their tenets as practiced, they lose their soul too. It's a dangerous thing when Jesus says it's inevitable. It must needs be. It's a necessity. It's compulsed. There's a pressure forcing these things. Make sure it's not you. And that's why it then starts talking about self-control. Self-discipline. Cutting off things that, you know, later. I mean, it's a very striking, exaggerated, or hyperbolic way to show you've got to be very careful. You have to be very careful. Better to enter life maimed or halt than having two hands or two feet to be cast into the eternal fire. This principle is addressed later in the book of Colossians in case somebody misses the point here. He's not actually saying go around and chop off members of the body. Paul says that doesn't hold any power. And that's not what Jesus is saying. I'm saying he's using this material hyperbolic statement to show you've got to practice self-control. You don't want to get into anybody's way. Don't cause others to stumble. Have you ever thought about this? I think this is a way of maybe concluding this point. You know, Matthew 7:13-14, there's the way. Acts 24:14, it comes up again, comes up several times in the book of Acts. I'm in the way. We sometimes sing that. I'm in the way, the glorious way. I'm in the glory land way. On my way to heaven, I'm in the way. We'll be sure it's the narrow gate that gave access to the restricted way. That's the way, the Lord's way. Jeremiah 6:16, the old paths now, and even the Jews had the old paths. We've got the old traditions. Stay in the way. Have you ever thought about it like this? You're either in the way, Matthew 7:13-14, or you're in the way. Get out of the way. How many times do you have to say that? Get out of my way. You're bothering me, son. Move over, child. I wish that car'd get out of the way. You ever said that? What does that driver think he's doing? You ever said that? Somebody seems to be quite often in the way. Regarding heaven and hell, it's like that all the time. Somebody, even people that smile and smell good and look nice, and even that discuss religion, oftentimes are in the way because they're not in the way. And so they pose a threat, a danger, a hazard, a risk to my soul. And I have to stave off the influence of that person while I glory in anything about them that is good that I can see. I have to be very, very careful that I be not allured into the reception of a doctrine but by their life that they testify to and give support to, because he looks so sincere. She talks so sweetly. They are so kind. But they are not in the way. And so you can be very charmed. You can be very much put at risk if you don't determine to settle things in your mind to stay in the way, with a capital W, the Lord's way. I think we'll just stop right there. Come back with another point this afternoon. But all of these things the Bible talks about, things are going to happen. Somebody's going to come along and want another king. Somebody's going to come along and they're going to apostatize from Judaism. And later, even in the gospel, apostatize from the faith. As the Spirit says expressly in later days, they will do. And somebody, somewhere, is going to cause somebody to fall. Make sure it won't be you. We'll pick up this in our afternoon session. If you're here this morning and not a Christian, come in faith, repent of your sins, make the good confession, be baptized into Christ for the remission of every sin. If you've done that and gone astray, come home now. While together we stand, while we sing, won't you come?